part of the empathic network is the ability to self-regulate, and that our brains are wired for self-other distinction. When we're tired, exhausted, burned out, that line between this is happening to that person, not to me, gets very fuzzy. And we can start to see, like, I can't deal with one more person crying today, one more person who's in distress. I'm going to shut down. But that is not because empathy is bad. It's because the systems that are producing overworked, overburdened, unsupported people is flawed.
Welcome to Flourishing in Medicine, from Surviving to Thriving. I'm your host, Dr. Mick Krasner. This podcast is produced by MPRO, a medical professional liability insurance carrier from New York State, committed through its multiple peer support offerings to helping support the physicians they protect. The title of today's podcast is Building Institutional Resilience, Dr. Helen Reese on Empathy and Support in Medicine. Helen Reese, MD, is a chief scientist and chairman of Empathetics and associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She also directs the Empathy and Relational Science Program at the Massachusetts General Hospital. In addition, she is the author of The Empathy Effect and a core member of the Consortium for Research on Emotional Intelligence in Organizations and faculty of the Harvard Macy Institute. She is a practicing psychiatrist who developed an empathy training approach based on research on neurobiology and physiology of empathy that's been rigorously tested in pilot studies and randomized controlled trials at Massachusetts General Hospital. In this wonderful conversation, Dr. Reese shares the influence of her family's experience as refugees from war-torn Europe, which sensitized her to trauma and resilience. Her interest in psychiatry began during medical school. She was drawn to understanding the mind and healing through narratives and empathy. She points out that although a small percentage of people lack the neural mechanisms for empathy, for most of us, empathy is a mutable trait influenced by environment and mental state. And importantly, and this actually was really an important thing she wanted to point out, that burnout among healthcare professionals diminishes their lack or the capacity for empathy. Not because empathy is inherently harmful at all. That was mistakenly believed in the past, but due to overwhelming demands and flawed systems within which these health professionals work, empathy has a negative effect. Helen discusses four pillars of what she describes as institutional resilience, and they are supporting healthcare workers with safe environments, caring communication, community cohesion, and mental health normalization. And she shared her results about the value of empathy training, demonstrating improved wellness and retention rates and significantly reduced medical costs for a medical group. She is a passionate, inspiring, kind, and dare I say, very empathic speaker and listener. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Welcome, Dr. Reese, to Flourishing in Medicine. It's just so lovely to have you. I haven't seen you for some time, but I'm really happy to have you on and have this conversation with you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'd like to start with what I start with all the guests, really, is you to tell us a little story about why medicine, actually, to begin with. You know, people come into medicine for a whole variety of reasons, and there's a whole lot of influences in their lives, maybe early influences in their families or people close to them, or something that happened in your educational journey along the way. And perhaps you can share with us, what was that really early or the earliest things you can remember that motivated you to enter into this challenging and wonderful profession?
I think the answer to your question is multidimensional. You know, my earliest memories were recognizing that my parents had come from war-torn Europe as refugees. And so there were many stories of trauma that sensitized me to people who had suffered. In spite of that, they had tremendous resilience and created a very good life here in the United States. And I also had a brother who had a congenital issue that required an operation that had never been done before to heal some stability from a missing bone in his neck. And so that was a very memorable experience because I was in seventh grade and he was in fourth grade. And so the the desire to help and the desire to recognize suffering, I think, was very evident to me as an early teenager, and wanting to go into a health profession was just something I always wanted to do.
Thank you. Would you tell us then about from that point, and you decided to do all the preparatory things one has to do to prepare for the medical education experience. Walk us through how that happened and how you got interested in psychiatry.
My interest in psychiatry was kind of a surprise, but it started in my first year of medical school when I realized that the reading assignments and the literature that I was most drawn to was actually the psychiatric courses that we took. And it just, I think the life of the mind was way more interesting to me than the miracle that our human bodies are, which was also just a fascinating and very privileged education that I'm so grateful for. But how the mind works and how people heal from trauma, how people come to make sense of their experience, and, you know, how you can learn to draw out a narrative from people who have been harmed and who are hurting and who are suffering from mental illness was just a natural like magnet for me. I went to medical school thinking I would become an internist. And at one point I loved surgery. And then I thought if I had to make a choice, it would be psychiatry. So that's where I ended up.
Well, you've mentioned several things, Helen, that has sort of sparked my interest. One is the use of the word narrative that you mentioned, making sense of our traumas, healing through making sense. And at some point, you realized or learned or had the experiences that empathy or the empathic resonance that we have was actually central to not only your work as a physician and especially as a psychiatrist, I wouldn't even say especially, but as a psychiatrist, but also our lives as human beings. So what I'd really love to hear now is a little bit about how you got interested in empathy as an entity, as a dynamic, as a, say, research subject, as well as what it meant personally for you.
That's such a great question. And it really happened in my last year of psychiatry residency. So all during the training period, we learned about obviously psychopharmacology, but again, I was way more drawn to psychotherapy because it had to do with understanding people. And so we learned Freudian theory, which was all about how these drives motivate people, the drive of aggression and sex, and how that underpinned people's behavior. We learned about ego psychology. We learned about, you know, relational psychology. And, you know, it was sort of foundations of building understanding, you know, that we're not just these organisms driven by adrenaline and, you know, passion and rage, but that we really seek to be understood. And when I became familiar with the work of Heinz Kohut, that's when I really felt like I had learned what was really going to impact my patients and heal them. And so Kohut is famous for having really become the father of what's called self-psychology. And it may sound like we're talking about being selfish, but it's just the opposite. Self-psychology, the underlying principle is that when people feel understood, that their life is relatable, shareable, and they find somebody who says that happened to me too, or I understand that, that is the healing power. And he called that empathy. And he's known for saying that empathy is psychological oxygen. And so I had a really great teacher who did a seminar on self-psychology. And this was just an elective. His name was Dr. Geist. And he took us through several cases where by purely reflecting back and listening and really understanding where that person's desire to be understood lay, we could get a narrative out of them that would be the secret to understanding how they saw the world, how they felt injured, how they felt misunderstood, and just provide a listening ear that validated how they saw the world. And once you established that connection, you had the trust to then work with things that might have been a little irrational or misperceptions. You had won or earned the credit to gently challenge some assumptions that maybe were interfering with getting along with others or even with getting along with themselves.
So let me just reflect on something that you said. It had to do with this need to be understood, and that's sort of a central to what Hans Kohut and this self-psychology field was talking about, and just the power that you just described of actually making that connection and then building that trust as being almost necessary in order to enact the sort of oath that we take as healers, as physicians, to actually do the work that we do. I watched your TED talk, your TEDx talk from Middlebury from 10 or so years ago. It's just fantastic, which we'll also link in the show notes. You spoke of empathy and how we all want to be seen, heard, and have our needs met, kind of what you were just talking about. But you also added that our survival depends on our capacity for empathy. And I'm thinking about Darwin, and Darwin did actually seem to write more about empathy or sympathy, I think is what the word he used, more than the fight, flight, freeze reactions. And I just wonder if you can unpack that for us. Say a little bit more about how our survival is so intimately connected with our empathic capacities.
It's nice that you've mentioned Darwin, because many people think it was all about survival of the fittest. Like, if you can just run faster and get the heck out of danger, we were all set. So it was, if you're the strongest and if you're the mightiest, you're going to survive. But Darwin actually challenged that, because Darwin, when he was really examining how animal and human societies worked, he noticed that survival had more to do with cooperation, reciprocity, and collaboration than just beating the other person out. So obviously you might run the fastest, but you might need a few more people to be running to look where the next field that had food. You can't do it by yourself. And so I think it's a paradox that Darwin is sort of famous for introducing the survival of the fittest concept, when he actually wrote a paper about compassion. And he understood the cooperative nature of humans mostly through the lens of the fact that we care because we hurt when we see other people hurting. And that, of course, leads us to the neurobiology of empathy, which is the fact that when we observe other people suffering, our own pain centers get activated. And I use this example in the TEDx talk because I think it's so apt that if you're in a parking lot and you see somebody get their hand slammed in a car door, we don't just passively look at that and say, oh, wow, look at that. We flinch. And why do we flinch? Because nothing has touched us, but our pain centers recognize that as a very painful stimulus. And so Darwin understood that we flinch for two reasons. The first is we learn, don't slam your hand in a car door because it really hurts. So we can learn vicariously by watching others in pain. And equally important, we experience to some attenuated degree that this person has just really gotten injured. They hurt. And when things are working well, that motivates. So empathy is in part motivation to help. And then when we actually do it, that is an act of compassion. So many people mix up empathy and compassion. And I think the easiest way to distinguish the two is that empathy is the input. Empathy is what we perceive, and then it hits our pain and emotional centers. And if we register that someone is in pain just by seeing their face, their tone of voice, it doesn't have to be an actual physical injury. something happens in our pain centers to say, this was a noxious stimulus. This person is hurting. And if everything's working well, like if we're not distracted, burned out, or exhausted, it motivates us to help. And then when we actually do the helping behavior, that's the efferent or the output. And that is compassion.
That is a really useful model or kind of metaphor to use, the input and the output, that empathy motivates us to enact compassion. And I really like what you just said about when we're not, say, burnt out or there's other factors. You know, Eve Ekman, a colleague of ours, and I wrote this paper on the neuroscience of empathy. And in certain situations, because of our conditioning or certain circumstances, we may, rather than enact compassion, become distressed ourselves, let's say, or other distance other people. So I think that's a really useful way of looking at it. A lot of your work, which I want to point out to our listeners, has been really revolutionary in a certain way, in that it raised the question, studied it, and then showed that one can cultivate, or we could say learn empathy, but I think you would probably not use that term, learn empathy. I would think maybe what I get from reading your work is learn to realize that empathy is already inherent in our nervous systems, and it's about kind of bringing that online and using that in a way of creating connection to motivate us to then act in compassionate ways. Can you say a little bit about learning, how you discovered that we can actually cultivate, let's use that, or realize the empathy that's already inherent in us?
Well, I agree with you that most people, except for maybe 1-4% of people, have the neurological makeup for empathy. There certainly are people who do not react to seeing other people in pain with pain themselves. They're sociopaths and people who are, I think they're missing the mirror neurons to give them that quick hit of pain that makes them care. Some sociopaths actually enjoy seeing people in pain. So we're just putting those people aside because I don't think there's a whole lot you can do about people who lack the neural mechanism for this survival technique. The rest of us have to face the fact that empathy is a mutable trait. It's not something you have that's baked in, that it's got the same strength no matter what's happening to you. So we've all experienced times when we've seen somebody who needs our help, and we're either distracted because we're helping somebody else, or we're rushing to something, or we're just exhausted and we can't find it within ourselves. So in every person, there is a mutable kind of spectrum of how much empathy they can show. This is why the epidemic of burnout in healthcare is so excruciatingly damaging, because burned out people, they tend to focus on their own distress more than the distress of others. And there's one really important clarification I want to make, because at some point in the early 2000s, or maybe in the 2010 decade, this notion that empathy causes burnout started to get some followers. And I think it was really a disservice. Empathy, when it's working as it should, gives us a touch of somebody else's painful experience or their suffering experience. Our whole pain matrix does not light up when we see others in pain. Only part of it does. And that's to say, hey, take notice, this person is hurting. If we are too distracted, we might just feel like, oh, not one more person needing my help, and start to feel overburdened. But that is not what empathy is supposed to be doing for us. It's supposed to give us just a light hit of someone needs us. And what many people who are in the empathy causes burnout and distress don't realize is that part of the empathic network is the ability to self-regulate, and that our brains are wired for self-other distinction. When we're tired, exhausted, burned out, that line between this is happening to that person, not to me, gets very fuzzy. And we can start to see, like, I can't deal with one more person crying today, one more person who's in distress. I'm going to shut down. But that is not because empathy is bad. It's because the systems that are producing overworked, overburdened, unsupported people is flawed. So at Empathetics, a big part of our training involves self-regulation skills. And I think you and Eve were very clear that you need to develop ways to manage the distress if it's becoming overwhelming, or you may need to take a break. You may need to say, I need some time off. But when our empathy gets that challenged, that we're not responding well, we are in danger, our patients are in danger, and the systems that we're working in are in peril.
Thank you for that clarification. And it is an important point, so I'm glad you mentioned that. What I'm taking from this is, maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but in the right environment or in the more normal environment, empathy is doing exactly what it is designed to do. And that, I think, can be shift this conversation to discussing the world of medicine for physicians. This podcast, after all, is called Flourishing in Medicine from Surviving to Thriving. You've spoken, Helen, about how employers want engaged and productive workers. Patients want to feel cared for by their health professionals. And you point out that those who do not have longer recovery, poorer immune function. Students who are disengaged are more likely to drop out. Marriages without empathy are more likely to fail. I'm thinking of the Gottmans and, you know, seeing actually contempt within very brief periods of watching couples communicate. So I ask, what do we know about empathy's role in physician wellness? And it's nice that it's coming after that clarification that you said about the mistaking of research connecting empathy, physician empathy, and poorer well-being. So the role of empathy in physician wellness, burnout, and distress related to, say, quality of care, quality of caring, and also just meaning and satisfaction as a professional. And also, what can we do about it?
So this is a critically important question. What can we do for these healthcare physicians, nurses, and other providers? The first thing that we need to do, and we're doing this at Empathetics, is teaching about self-empathy. Now, that is, those two words have not been used together until I realized during the pandemic that to try to talk to any health provider about being more empathetic to patients was going to be actually harmful. They were already way beyond their physical and emotional capacities. They were scared for their own lives, scared for bringing the contagion home to their families. And to start talking about, well, you still need to be more empathetic. And oh, by the way, you can't go into the room with a family member. Like, everything was working against these people. And I realized throughout medical training, we never, ever had a course in how to take care of yourself. It was always put the patient first. It's not about you. We learned stoicism, high standards for excellence, taking the oath, taking the high moral ground. And those are all wonderful expectations. But no one ever talked about what you need personally in order to sustain those types of attitudes and values. And so the idea that people have to learn to take care of themselves, I think it's a new dawn. And the expansion of wellness officers in health systems across the country is a start. At least, you know, health systems are realizing we need to promote wellness. Like, this is not just a luxury. We've got to do something. And I go to many wellness and burnout conferences, and I think the need is very acknowledged. I'm not so sure that budgets are aligned as they should be with understanding that people need to learn not just about self-care, which kind of puts the whole burden on the healthcare worker, but also how do you create an empathic organization? How do you create a place where people's needs, their desire to do the right thing is backed and supported with the ability to do the right thing by recognizing these people are human beings. And many of them are working not just during the day, but then spending 4 hours at home at night doing the charting. You can't expect people to be able to be very patient focused while also requiring them to enter all kinds of documentation into the electronic health record, because that pulls their faces away, it pulls their attention away, and it's just impossible to be looking at two things at the same time. So my hope is that some of the promises of artificial intelligence with recording what's going on while, you know, a patient visit is happening, so that the physician is freed up from having to type everything him or herself, that some of these innovations will actually free people up to be truly patient-centered.
I agree with you. I think there's great promise in that, and I hope that we can craft it and move it in that direction. I'm going to also include Empathetics and the contacts and the website in the show notes, because what you have offered to organizations and individuals is really a wonderful thing. And I think people, our listeners, would want to know about that. I also really appreciate how you started with this sense that it's not something you have to go do, take a course to become empathic. Although one can cultivate it, there's some skills, because like you say, of the differing natures of our interaction between ourselves and our own empathic neurophysiology and the environments in which we work. I always like to also say, like in my own teaching that some people could call resilience training, which now I shudder at because I think physicians and other health professionals also are reactive to the need to go have a training to become more resilient. They're already resilient. Health professionals, in fact, by most measures, have greater degrees of resilience. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but you would probably argue that they're already empathic by virtue of being human, number one. And also there's something about, say, your origin story that you shared with us about being moved in a certain way by the suffering of others that have brought us into this profession in the first place. I think that sets us in some way as a special case. I don't want to say special, but as a subset of empathic humans. I'm wondering if you could just comment, what could organizations and healthcare institutions do to make the culture more, we could call it empathically aware, empathically intelligent? I'm thinking about the relationship, and I know you've done some work on this, between emotional intelligence and how that relates to success and well-being among individuals and organizations, how that may mirror what we could call, what I'm calling maybe incorrectly, empathic intelligence. Is there something along those lines that could work for organizations and institutions?
Well, you're really tapping into the subject of an article I wrote, the Journal of Communication in Healthcare. It was called Institutional Resilience. And I realized exactly what you just said. Doctors and nurses are some of the most resilient people in the world. Just to get through their training, you've got to be pretty resilient. So the idea that these people suddenly need resilience training, we have to look at what's caused the change. And so institutional empathy begins with recognizing that your workforce is comprised of human beings who have needs, who in many cases have partners, families, loved ones, that their job is not the only thing they have to take care of. So you just think about a working female physician, you know, and whether it's the male or the female who's the primary caretaker, still today it's most often the female who's having the children, bearing the children, and adding that responsibility to taking care of a full caseload of patients. That's a lot of need. And to not recognize that these people need support is just a giant mistake. So in my article, I talk about the need for institutional resilience by recognizing that you won't have an institution if you don't have healthy people working in it. And they deserve, I think, four basic things. They deserve a safe environment. That means get the PPE ready now for the next epidemic, because it's going to come and we better not fall on our faces again. Make sure you have a safe environment. Number two, use communication that is not just accurate, but caring. many people were threatened if they didn't come to work when we didn't know what the pandemic was all about. They were told, you're going to lose your bonus, you're not going to get your retirement. Like, people were actually scared to death to come to work and then go home and infect their children. And instead of just being heard and like talking to them and saying what could be done to make these fears be somewhat allayed, they were threatened. I think this was the biggest mistake. It just made people throw their hands up. Like, what, you know, what a dilemma that is. And we need community cohesion. People were so isolated, and they still are. You know, many people haven't seen their colleagues in like 5 years, and they're suffering alone. And the fourth is normalizing a need for mental health. So those are the four points I raise. And I want to come back to, what can institutions do? And you said, like, not everybody can take a course in self-care, but I'm going to challenge that, because that is how we start with empathy training now. We start with a brief course or workshop on self-empathy. And it's not just make sure you exercise and eat good food. It's also giving people a chance to come together and really process their trauma. So we can't skip over that healing process. And I know from being a psychiatrist, you can't have someone go through trauma and say, okay, well, that was then, but this is now. And now let's just get back to normal. And that's what a lot of places let's just like get back to, there's no normal now. The world has changed, and we need to normalize the need for self-care. And also, it's a way for the organization to show that they care about their people, right? And so I think one of the key, most rewarding things that have happened by bringing empathy education and skills workshops and e-learning to organizations is that one of our partners reported that not only did their burnout, it got better. The mini Z scores got higher with empathetics trained physicians. Their wellness scores got better. And this would be probably the most important thing for hospital CEOs to hear. We had a 17 times greater retention rate in empathetics trained doctors. And so this meant that only 0.5 of the empathetics cohort of over 400 doctors in this one cohort, only 0.5 of them left their job during 2023, whereas 8.5 who weren't trained in empathy left their jobs. This means that it saved this one big medical group almost $19 million because they didn't have to hire new people, which costs about $1 million per doctor. So many times at conferences, people say, what's the ROI? How can we convince people? What can we say that people understand at the top that this is not just a nice to have? This is going to actually save you money. You know, and it's just such a great statistic to share, because it really proves that when you do the right thing, you're always going to save money. Sometimes it takes a while to realize it. But we've got to get the focus back on being a caring institution. And some of them are coming around, and it's really rewarding to see that it's being prioritized.
Well, thank you, number one, for pushing back on that notion that just another thing we have to do to learn about. And, you know, our organizations, institutions often require us, mandate us to take all sorts of things on risk management, on sensitivity training. If there's an effective way to train this, and if you have that kind of return, that's fantastic. So thanks for going over that. And also thank you for going over those four components that I think are really important: the safety, the caring communication, community cohesion, and then recognizing the need for mental health supports. We're coming down to the end of this conversation, Helen, and I feel like I'm going to miss talking with you because I'd like to go on and on, but maybe we'll have to have you back. Two things. First, I'd like you to, if you could, share a personal experience that for you illustrates the intersection of empathy and your sense of meaning, purpose, well-being, we could say flourishing as a physician. And then after that, and I'll remind you if you haven't gotten to that, I'd really love to know, like, what do you do to take care of yourself? What do you do for fun and enjoyment that really nourishes you and keeps you in the game, keeps you so curious and passionate and excited about what you're doing?
Those are such great questions. So because I'm a psychiatrist, I can't share the multiple stories of having patients say how grateful they are to have someone listen, to sort through. Sometimes they're very conflicted, messy emotions to come out, to appreciate what's going on around them and to get a new perspective and to heal. So I can't share any of those, but I am going to share a story of a nurse who was so empathetic to me when my dad was on his deathbed. My parents live on the West Coast, and I got a call that said, your father is not doing well and he's in the hospital and we're not sure he's going to make it till the next day. So if you want to come say goodbye, you need to get here. So I got the last seat on an airplane from Boston to Portland. And my sister picked me up and we went to my dad's hospital room, and his breathing was very labored. And you know, that they talk about the death. It was just awful. But I got to sit and hold his hand. And I got to say the things that were most important to him. You know, he lost his parents in World War II when he was 14. And he always believed he would see them in the afterlife. And I held his hand and I said, Dad, your parents are going to be so happy to see you when you go on the other side. And he literally took three slow breaths and his heart stopped. And I had said, I love you and all the other things, but that was, I was there when his spirit left his body. And a nurse named Teresa came into the room and she said, did he just pass? Because the monitor in the nurse's station went flat. And I said, I think so. And she said, he was waiting for you. And I really believe he was. I mean, it was such a transition from seeing such suffering to letting go. And I just thought those simple words, and I wrote to that nurse, and I hope she got the no, because I only knew her first name. But I sent her a copy of my book, and you know, it's one of these things, I just wish and hope that she got it, because I didn't hear back. But it's just an example of saying just the right thing to a grieving family member can just make you feel like, you know, I feel like I barely got there in time, but like it was what he needed to hear. And I forgot your last question. Oh, what do I do to take care of myself? Well, thanks to hiring a new CEO at Empathetics, I am now practicing more self-care than I have in the last decade. So I've been exercising, just taking really good care of myself physically because I've been sitting at the computer too much. But really one of my favorite self-care things to do is in the morning when it's early, before I start work, I think about who would just enjoy getting a postcard? Like who could I just connect with or send a text? But often it's actually writing something and putting a postcard stamp on it and just telling people in my little universe that I'm thinking of them. And that is, I think that what I want to end with is when we really feel like we're connecting meaningfully with somebody, it's called exquisite empathy. Because, you know, you get this grateful text or a little line back. And I just want to end with, when you give caring and love out to people, it just comes back. And so it's like an empathy loop. So we're not draining ourselves when we're being empathetic. We're fulfilling ourselves.
That is such a lovely way to end. Thank you so much. I'm thinking about my first question, comment, one of my first questions or comments to you, and how both the story of your father's passing and also this story of what you do to kind of feed that feedback loop for your own empathy. And it has to do with how we all want to be seen, heard, and have our needs met. And boy, who wouldn't love to get a postcard from a friend that you haven't heard from, just that you're thinking of them, and who wouldn't want to hear what, you know, we have been carrying with us our entire lives that would be reassuring and comforting in those very important moments at the end. So it's just been lovely, wonderful. Thank you so much, Helen, and look forward to connecting in the future.
Nick, you made this such a nice conversation. I really have enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for listening. I'll include a summary of today's podcast and links about Dr. Rees and other references that we discussed in the show notes. And I'd like to conclude by sharing another practical exercise that you can do from time to time to help you flourish. So what I'd like you to do is find a magazine or a book with photographs or paintings or drawings of people, and please open that and begin to look at the photographs. And as you do, bring awareness to your own somatic, emotional, and cognitive experience. As you turn the pages of this book or magazine and view other photographs, continue to notice this natural curiosity, the natural feelings, the natural sensations that are part of the experience of empathy. Noticing at any point arising feelings or thoughts of othering or distancing or even disdain if present, not judging those, but considering the possibility that other aspects of your lived experience that you have carried into this moment influence, filter the natural arising of empathy. You may wish to repeat this practice from time to time, noticing the effects of different times of day and different moods that you're in or different demands that you're carrying that are having on this experience of empathy. I hope you found this podcast and the simple exercise useful to you, and look very forward to having you join us for the next episode of Flourishing in Medicine, From Surviving to Thriving. To learn more about MPRO, please visit www.mympro.com. If you'd like to know more about MPRO's peer support programs, visit www.mympro.com/peer-support. I'd like to thank Jerry Donahue, Vice President of Education at MPRO, for producing this podcast, and Stan Saint-Jour for his technical expertise in recording and editing. If you're a physician or medical student and in need of urgent support, consider the physician support line at 1-888-409-0141. This support line provides a safe space to discuss immediate life stressors with a volunteer psychiatrist colleague who's uniquely trained in mental wellness and has had similar shared experience of this profession. For more information about me and my work, please visit www.mickkrasnermd.com or www.mindfulpracticeinmedicine.com. Until next time.